You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, June 16th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Where's Jay?
Where is Jay?
Jay is busy on his super secret project.
Vaccinating orphans in Rwanda.
That's exactly right. How'd you know?
I'm psychic.
Oh, I thought he was inserting little drops of morphine into the tips of acupuncture needles in China.
I thought he was hiking through the Andes looking for the elusive Yeti.
I thought he was at Lourdes curing people of their illnesses. So a few things happened around this time in history, you know. So it was June 27th, when you're all listening to this. In 1847, New York and Boston were linked together by telegraph wires, making the first podcast transmission possible. That sounded like this. Now, could you imagine a podcast over telegraph? Oh, something else happened on this date. In 1978, according to this, the first pen with truly erasable ink, the Gillette Eraser Mate, was invented. I think that is possibly the worst invention in history.
Why?
That
pen never worked right. The ink was blotchy. You know, you went to erase the stuff. It more or less, you know, it kind of erased it and kind of smeared it at the same time around the paper. So you had to go back and turn the eraser around to the other side that didn't have the blotch of ink on it. It was a mess.
I disagree. I have only fond memories of my erasable ink pen.
This is going to make a great poll on the forums when we put this episode up.
Steve, remember using it in Canterbury?
I do. I remember using it. You know, it wasn't perfectly erasable. You would take a little bit of the top layer of the actual paper off if you wanted to get a clean erase. But it was better than nothing. You know, you had some ability to make some minor corrections.
Pencil works just fine.
Assuming you had to use a pen, it was not a bad option.
It was never an invention that impressed me.
Well, where's the erasable ink pen now?
Where's your erasable ink pen now? See?
Well, we have a few news items to go through this week. The first one is about a junior supernova in two respects.
It's named after its father?
Nope.
The discoverer, for one.
Yeah, the person who it was discovered by a teenager, a 14-year-old student, Carolyn Moore, was the first one to actually discover this supernova.
Ah, cool.
How awesome is that?
It had to be confirmed at actual observatories, but she's the first one who saw it, so she got credit for it. And it's junior because it's a tiny supernova, and it's the first one of its kind actually observed.
The first one of its kind?
Yeah.
It's a real anomaly. So, either it was a very, very weak supernova or it was a very, very strong nova. It's kind of like in the middle, you know, middle ground.
Yeah, pretty much right in the middle.
All right, well, how do you separate the two? What's the division?
Well, it's interesting. It's new, so we don't know. So one of the hypotheses that this is a failed type 1 supernova.
Right.
Type 1A supernova is what happens when you have a white dwarf, which slowly collects matter from a partner star. And at some point, it reaches a critical mass where it then collapses and explodes in a supernova. That's a type 1A supernova. The good thing about that is that all type 1 supernova are exactly the same size. Because, you know, you have a white dwarf slowly gathering matter, and when it reaches the same critical mass, it then collapses and explodes. So for that reason, type 1A supernovas are what's known as a standard candle, in that you know how bright they are, absolutely, and therefore you can use their apparent brightness to tell exactly how far away they are.
If it's really, really dim, then it's got to be really far away.
That's right. But here we have a supernova occurring in a galaxy of a known distance, about 70 million light years away, but it's too faint for a type 1A supernova, and also for the other known types of supernova as well. So what they think might have happened is that a white dwarf got to the critical mass and went through the process of exploding as a type 1A supernova, but didn't quite make it, didn't burn all of the matter in the star. It didn't have a complete explosion. But they're not. That's just really speculation at this point. They're not sure how and why that would happen. It's very interesting.
You imagine this 14-year-old girl, not only does she see a supernova before anybody else on the planet, but she discovers what might be a new class of supernova. How amazing is that?
That's big. Yep. That's awesome.
And this girl just peaked at 14.
I smell a Nobel Prize.
You think so?
When she's 22.
But bringing this down to Earth a little bit, there was another story involving an astronomical event and a young person. I think we were sent this by about
3,000 people.
About 3,000 people, yeah, something
at
like
least.
That.
I think I counted.
This is the boy hit by a meteorite is the headline. Although I think technically you would be hit by a meteor, right? Because it has to be on the ground before it's a meteorite.
I thought it was the other way around.
Is that true, Bob?
No, meteor is in the sky and the meteorite is on the ground.
Yeah, that's what we just said.
Yeah, but the headline says hit by meteorite. But it
was on the ground and then it would have jumped off.
Yeah, only if it bounced off the ground, right?
Yeah, but isn't that what they said happened?
Well, we don't know. This is the story we get.
Wait, what do you call it in space?
It's an asteroid.
It's not a meteoroid?
It could be a meteoroid.
Yeah, meteoroid. I'm
sure it is.
Hemorrhoid?
A hemorrhoid, yeah.
That's just when it's in Uranus.
Oh.
There's a 14, also 14 years old, by coincidence, a 14-year-old German boy said he was hit in the hand by a pea-sized meteorite that scared the quote-unquote bejesus out of him and left him with a scar.
That's good.
Bejesus
kills,
term.
Actually. So it's really good that they got that out of him.
Now, some reports say that the meteor was traveling at 30,000 kilometers an hour, although I don't know how they would know that. And that
they
also can't be true, because that's right, would have taken the kid's arm off.
Yeah,
even a tiny thing going that fast, that's like 10 times faster than a bullet.
They said it made a small crater or something in the ground, and yet it only somehow nicked him.
Bounced off his skin.
He would have a nice neat hole in the exact shape of the meteor.
like Wile E. Coyote.
Room, right?
Yeah.
So there's a few possibilities here. Assuming that there's any truth to this story at all, one possibility is that the meteor had broken up into pieces and a bigger chunk hit the ground and made the crater. And a tiny piece is what hit the kid. That's possible. Mm. Although most meteors... once they hit the atmosphere, they slow down pretty much to their terminal velocity, as if you just drop them. So they're actually not traveling that fast.
That's about 200 kilometers per hour, according to
Phil
Plate.
Still enough to penetrate your skin, though.
It would hurt, you know. But if you know a small, like a little pebble, you know,
moving at 200 kilometers per hour would. Still, like,
it'd leave a scar and it would hurt, but it could be compatible with this story, right? It wouldn't rip his arm off or put a hole through his hand or something, right? Another possibility is that the meteor hit the ground and then this kid got hit by a rock that was kicked up by the impact of the meteor.
That's what I think.
That's the most likely thing.
So I think that one's fiction. I mean, science. We're not there yet.
Oh, but then, you know, I was reading Phil's entry on this on Bad Astronomy.
Oh, what did he say?
The Telegraph, I think, broke the story and said that someone named Ansgar Cordum, who is director of Germany's Walter Hohmann Observatory, said it's a real meteorite, therefore it's very valuable to collectors and scientists. But Phil happens to be friends with a Dutch science writer named Govert Schilling, who talked to Cordum and says that Cordum says he never saw the meteorite and that he was misquoted.
Yeah.
Which, that's very suspicious, you know.
Yeah.
Misquoted by the media about science? Never.
I think it's more likely to be sloppy journalism than the story's entirely made up. But you're right, it does call into question the veracity of the report.
Wow.
If we learn anything more about it, we'll let you know. But it's not impossible that people could get hit by meteors. There's a few reported cases.
People have,
over the years.
There are.
Talk about bad luck.
You would think it is probably the most improbable thing that could happen to somebody, whatever odds you can come up with, you know, that's what you think, you know, like it would basically never happen. But probability and statistics would tell you that actually it should happen, and probably even more than it's reported, and maybe people don't even realize that what has happened, that they were hit by a fragment or something like that.
Let's go on to the next news item. This one has to do with a study looking at a new heuristic. And it occurred to me that I don't think we've ever actually talked about heuristics much on this podcast. Have we? I mean, you guys remember us talking about it before?
No.
Actually, no.
No.
It's fairly common.
I took a class on heuristics once.
You did?
Bored me to tears.
Really? I think they're cool.
Might have been the professor.
Briefly, heuristics are like a mental shortcut. They are a way of coming to a rapid conclusion using down and dirty rules of thumb that will get you to a close approximation of the truth without having to go through like the detailed analysis to get to a more accurate conclusion. And psychologists talk about heuristics in terms of describing the mental shortcuts that people tend to make. They're of interest to skeptics and to critical thinkers in the same way that logical fallacies are, because these heuristics lead to biases in the way people think, and therefore they could lead you to erroneous conclusions. A very common example of a heuristic, for example, is the representative or representativeness heuristic. In this one, we tend to assume commonality between objects or people who have similar appearance or properties. So here's a typical example. If you meet somebody and they have the personality characteristics that you would typically associate, let's say, with a librarian, quiet, bookish, and then you're asked to estimate what's the probability that this person is in fact a librarian, most people would assign it a very high probability, relatively, a much higher probability than is accurate. The reason is that the representative heuristic leads us to conclude this guy seems like a representative, you know, example of a librarian. Therefore, he probably is a librarian. However, if you consider the what's called the base rate, you know, the number of people who are in fact librarians is actually quite low. And if you consider that, it becomes more obvious that, well, the probability that this guy's a librarian is actually quite low. But you grossly overestimated that probability because of this representativeness heuristic. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Well, these researchers came up with another heuristic, which I think is quite interesting. And it is one in which we limit the number of dimensions that we consider when estimating the size or volume of something. For example, what they did was they showed subjects either pictures or actually live models of women of varying weight. And then they had them guess their actual weight. They also fed some of the subjects information about how tall the women were. Some of the time the information was accurate, and some of the time it was inaccurate. What they found was that the subjects estimated weight almost entirely based upon the width of the person and completely ignored height in their calculations, even when it was given to them as a figure. And being given inaccurate information about the height didn't alter their guesses, which is part of the reason why they concluded that it wasn't being taken into consideration. One of the interesting applications of this sort of shortcut that we make in estimating volume or amount is they also applied it to portion sizes. And what they found was that people estimated calories based upon the number of units rather than the actual volume of the portions, right?
That makes sense to me because a long time ago I learned that I just enjoy eating a lot of stuff. Mitch Hedberg did the joke about, you know, sometimes I like to eat rice because I'm just hungry and I want to eat 1,000 of something.
So This leads to what's called the unit bias. So I guess maybe we can call this the unit heuristic. Therefore, like if you eat a hamburger, in your mind, you're calculating your food intake as I ate a hamburger, one unit. You don't take into consideration how big the hamburger was. And you'll count a big hamburger the same as a small hamburger in estimating how much you ate.
Or what condiments were on it, or cheese.
Yeah, you don't consider these other variables, right. That leads people to underestimate, sometimes grossly underestimate, the number of calories they consume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And this is really interesting because what that means is as portion sizes have increased in our culture, people eat more calories. And this heuristic, that's been observed previously, and this heuristic explains why that is. Because we're not really considering portion sizes when we're subconsciously estimating how much we're eating.
I wonder how culturally dependent that is. Because at least we know in America, or maybe even just in the Northeast, portion sizes are crazy. You go to some restaurants and you can't possibly finish it. Yeah. And you feel, you know, somewhat compelled to make a good attempt, you know. But they're just crazy. And I wonder if that's true in Europe or other countries. Are portion sizes as crazy as they are in the United States?
Oh, portion sizes, I don't think, have increased as much in other countries as they have in the United States, just culturally. And I think it's, you know, there's interesting speculation as to why that is. The one that I've heard, I don't know how scientific this is, but one speculation is that it's really just a marketing strategy of restaurants and fast food and whatnot, you know, to provide more is a way of, you know, luring customers. So it was this competition just led to slowly increasing the portion sizes, and a proportional increase in caloric intake and therefore waistlines in the United States.
But not so much price, though, I would guess.
Right.
Well, yeah, and when you serve really crappy food, it gets even cheaper. So
dollar menu.
Yeah, people always wonder why people, you know, living on very low income go to KFC. Well, because you get, you know, a crap load
of food
for $3.99.
That's right. That's right.
You can get a couple of apples for that. But
plus they make great barbecue baked beans.
What this means is that for people who are trying to keep their caloric intake under control, to control their weight, you have to really consciously consider portion size. It also, and I've heard, one thing I've heard before, which to me sounded like, you know, old wives' tale kind of advice, just not really based on anything scientific, but I don't know if it's true or not. And that is, if you're trying to lose weight, if you're trying to control caloric intake, to eat more smaller things, you know, like, for example, you may go to restaurants that serve the sliders, right? The tiny hamburgers, and eat three tiny hamburgers instead of one big hamburger.
Oh, yeah. I'm on the White Castle diet.
Yeah. So just as an example. And from this perspective, it makes sense because you'll think you've eaten more because you've eaten more units. You've eaten more things, even though your overall caloric intake will be less. I wonder also how much just geometry plays into all of this because, you know, as you increase the linear dimensions of something, the volume increases much more, right?
Right, yeah.
So if you have a hamburger that looks only a little bit bigger, it may actually have a much greater volume, you know, than a smaller one, for example, just to stick with our hamburger example. So
hamburger.
And, you know, I feel like we talked about this before, but there was a study a short while back, I think last year, where researchers found that people ate more when the food was in those handy little 100-calorie packs that are all the rage now.
Oh, yeah.
Than they did when the food was in one large bag. Like if you have the little mini M&M bags and you have the big bag, you tend to eat like crap loads of those mini bags and just a few handfuls of the big bag. So it kind of backfires.
Well, we should talk about heuristics more, I think, on this podcast, is the bottom line.
Is that the bottom line, Steve?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to have to trust you.
They're so powerful because they're a reflex.
Yeah.
So you really, you know, you're not really thinking about it.
It's a hardwired bias. Yeah. Definitely a good thing to know about.
It is interesting.
Next item is one more astronomical item that Bob is going to tell us about.
Yeah, I found this one today. sounded interesting. Now, most scientists agree, maybe you guys have heard of this, that in a billion years, about, you know, give or take a few months, but in about a billion years, if all the other fill plate disasters do not happen, then the sun will fry all life on the Earth. You know, the sun is getting hotter, it's getting brighter, it's getting a little bigger, so in about a billion years, it's going to be just too hot for pretty much anything but bacteria. So,
and why should I care?
Because it's interesting.
Oh, okay.
and you shall see. And there's other reasons to care.
The robot that your brain is floating in at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
The robot that takes care of the jar that my head is floating in.
Yeah, that your brain will boil at, you know, at 800 degrees given your containment system. So you're gonna
shame.
You know, you'll be thinking about this, you know, in a billion years.
I'll be like, why wasn't I listening while Bob was talking during the podcast? What do I do?
Oh, what a fool I was.
Computer, call Bob Novella. Hello, Domino's. No!
I've wasted the last billion years of my life.
Do I have that podcast archived? But now, I mean, that's the common wisdom. In a billion years, it's going to get pretty nasty.
Very common.
But researchers, according to these researchers at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, they say that they've discovered a mechanism that could potentially double the lifespan of Earth's biosphere. So that means that life could potentially last a little over 2 billion years, 2.3 to be precise, 2.3 billion years in the future, which is cool. Good. I mean, hey, doubling the lifespan of the Earth's biosphere, that's cool. Plus also, there might be, somehow this feeds into the possibility of increasing the chance of finding extraterrestrial life. So interesting connection there. I was curious to see what they had to say about this. They just described this hypothesis this past June 1st on an online edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is their argument. This is basically what their you know, their chain of logic. They say that Earth maintains a certain temperature range throughout using a greenhouse effect. Now, the greenhouse gases on the Earth are water vapor, right, carbon dioxide, and methane, and they act as this insulating blanket absorbing and re-radiating thermal radiation, right, and it keeps the surface warm. It keeps the Earth within this range that it's generally been in for pretty much most of its life, this comfortable range that life can thrive in. But throughout its entire life, the sun has become brighter and hotter. And to put a more precise number on it, it becomes 10% more luminous every billion years. And 10% doesn't sound like a lot, but believe me, that's a lot. When 10% greater luminosity is pretty significant. So what happens is the amount of carbon dioxide has been reduced on the Earth in lockstep with the solar increase. And basically, some of the articles I've read said that, you know, in response, the Earth reduced the amount of carbon dioxide. I don't know if you could say there's this, you know, cause and effect relationship, but it sure seems that way, that when the Earth starts getting too hot, the amount of carbon dioxide decreases, which then will prevent the Earth from warming up. Right, the sun gets really hot, the Earth gets rid of some carbon dioxide somehow, some way, and then the Earth isn't as hot as it would have been. So that's pretty much how it's been going.
Does this mean we don't have to worry about global warming?
Woo-hoo! Well, oh, geez, man. People are talking about that. They actually tied into that, right? And they keep saying that, oh, we're worrying about the increase in carbon dioxide, but when throughout the history of the Earth, it's been going down and down. But it's not a good point. But the key point that they do stress is that they say that, and I quote, we're nearing the point where there's not enough carbon dioxide left to regulate temperatures following the same procedures, these procedures that I've been talking about. So that would be bad. That would mean that we could potentially reach a point, not, I don't know how far in the future, but not too far in the future, we could reach a point where there's actually not enough carbon dioxide left, which would cause most plants to suffocate. It would prevent photosynthesis. Clearly, that would not be good. Plants dying all over the place. Now, this wouldn't kill all plants, but it would kill most plants that rely on photosynthesis. Clearly, that would be devastating to the biosphere.
There's two possibilities there. So, yeah, over geological time, CO2 decreases, perhaps as a response of the biosphere to increasing solar output. And then as it gets lower and lower, it'll get to the point where there isn't enough CO2 to really support a lot of plant life on the Earth.
Right.
But perhaps before it gets to, maybe it won't get to that point, though. Unless we really understand what the mechanism is, I don't see how we can project this into the future or say what the limits are going to be.
But it's one possible model, right?
But we don't. It's actually just an observation. It's not really even a model yet. Because we don't know what the mechanism is.
They didn't discuss the mechanism in detail. Maybe they have fleshed it out, and I don't know. The research that I did didn't really discuss the actual mechanism.
I suspect we don't really know what the mechanism is, but we could look into it.
You might be right, and they didn't go into detail. Maybe that's why they didn't. Regardless, the Earth uses carbon dioxide to regulate temperature, and if we reach a certain point where there's not enough carbon dioxide left, then that's going to be a problem. Lots of plants could be dying, and it could affect the entire biosphere. So they're fixed. Their idea is that atmospheric pressure regulates temperature as well. So this is one of the big discoveries that they're claiming, is that the amount of stuff we have in our atmosphere, the amount of pressure we have in our atmosphere, actually is another way that temperature can be regulated. Specifically, it does this by broadening the infrared absorption lines of greenhouse gases. The way that they think we can reduce the atmospheric pressure then is to remove a lot of the molecular nitrogen in the atmosphere, right? The atmosphere is 78% nitrogen. It's non-reactive. It's really just filler. You don't need it for biology. So they figure that if you can get rid of a bunch of this nitrogen, it would lower the atmospheric pressure, and then the Earth could release some of this heat that's going to be building up in hundreds of millions of years.
To be thorough, there are some plants that do fix their own nitrogen from the atmosphere, so you can't say it's not totally biologically neutral.
No, and nitrogen is important for bacteria too.
Yeah.
They fix nitrogen. So clearly, yeah, it's non-reactive. And yeah, I guess I stress that too much. It is important down the chain. It's actually pretty critical for bacteria to fix the nitrogen that plants use. So the interesting thing was that they claim that we don't have to do anything to make this happen, because apparently it happens all by itself as the biosphere incorporates nitrogen into the cells. Your body has tons of nitrogen in it. Life needs nitrogen. So they say that the more life there is, the more nitrogen will be used. And then the less dense the atmosphere would be. That's where they kind of lost me, because, I mean, how much life do you need to make a significant impact in the atmospheric pressure of the Earth? I mean, I would think you would need a lot.
Well, plus I would think that we're at an equilibrium, right? We're in a steady state of nitrogen going in and going out.
Well, that's why I liked the last part of this article mentioned ways to test it. And I always like, you know, that's a clear marker, right, for pseudoscience, is that there's no way to test their claims. They had some interesting ways to test their claims, and so that was a good sign for me. And one of them was interesting, lava bubbles, right? If the atmospheric pressure, if this was true and the atmospheric pressure has been going down in the past of the Earth, then if you look at these lava bubbles that were created many, many, you know, millennia ago, that higher pressures produce smaller bubbles. So you compare lava bubbles, you know, current ones and very ancient ones, and if the bubbles are smaller in the past generally, then you could say that maybe there was probably higher pressure in the past then. If this is a universal process and this happens all over, then that means, you know, that equation in the Drake equation is going to have to be manipulated a bit. You know, how long does life last? If it lasts twice as long as we think, then basically you've got twice the chance of running into extraterrestrial life if they last a lot longer than we thought. And that's pretty much one of the conclusions they make. One of the researchers, Young, says that it didn't take very long to produce life on the planet, but it takes a very long time to develop advanced life. On Earth, this process took 4 billion years. Adding an additional billion years gives us more time to develop, more time to encounter advanced civilizations whose own existence might be prolonged by this mechanism. It gives us a chance to meet. So,
well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Brian Brushwood. Brian, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This is such an honor and a privilege.
Thanks. Brian is a performer and a magician and a lecturer and, of course, a skeptic. He's the author of several books, including Cheats, Cons, Swindles, and Tricks, 57 Ways to Scam a Free Drink. And it's interesting the way you found your way onto the Skeptic's Guide as a guest. Really, it was Evan's doing. He came across one of your lectures, I guess, and it became one of our Who's That Noisies.
Awesome. And how can I ask how you stumbled across it?
Well, I just do each week. I do research for that segment of the show, and I just plug in some keywords, you know, skeptic, paranormal,
idiot,
spiky
hair,
yeah,
a whole bunch of different. I think at one point, maybe when I typed in magic, you came up under that listing, and I saw you, and there was your lecture about skepticism, which you cover a lot of different things.
Too much, in my opinion, for such a short program.
Not enough for me, but it's broken up nicely into several segments. So I listened to a couple, and I grabbed a clip from one I liked, and it didn't take our audience very long to guess exactly who you were, whereas that was my first exposure to you, and I'm just sorry I hadn't heard about you sooner.
Oh, nothing to be ashamed of. Like I'm saying, I'm just a small fry guy who's just kind of getting started in this game, but now I'm curious because, I'm in a weird position in that I have zero qualifications whatsoever. I'm a goofball who sticks nails in his eyes for a living, and here I am. The only reason I put together the lecture is because I find myself at universities, and after the show, I do a few mind reading effects, and people say, well, what do you think of this guy, or what have you heard about this topic, and so on. And I was essentially giving an impromptu lecture of essentially the same material every single performance afterwards. It's like, well, heck, might as well make an official product out of it. And so I'm curious, from a qualified standpoint, when you tuned into it and saw what was going on, like, did your BS alarm go off and be like, who's this idiot? I'm curious what went on from your perspective.
Well, when I came across it, and it only took me a few moments to listen to it, and I knew you were pretty much right on the ball with everything. The names, the facts, the history, you go well into the history of all these, various really scams throughout the ages, and who came up with them first, and how they were introduced, and why people initially fell for them in certain cases, and how they've caught on and become part of our everyday culture.
Well, that's good. I'm clearly standing on the shoulders of giants, because like I say, I mean, I'm just, quoting people way, way smarter than me across the board on that stuff. There is one factual mistake, and I should go back and do it. I mixed up the names of the guys who started Crop Circles. It's Doug Chorley and Dave Bauer. I mixed their first and last names up or whatever, but I figure that
you'll never be forgiven for that.
I know. Clearly, everything is bogus because of that mistake.
Well, last time we talked about them, I just said Doug and Dave because I couldn't remember which name.
Oh, good. I'm glad I'm in good company here.
So I think you do a good job. I heard a lot of your lectures. A lot of them are on YouTube, and we'll, of course, provide links for our listeners to them. I have nits to pick about some of the tiny details, which, of course, we run into the same thing. If we talk about any topic, there's guaranteed to be listeners out there who are experts in the very narrow field that we're talking about, and we always get subtle things wrong. There's always, if you're an expert in something,
of course,
you're always going to want to tweak it. So you were talking about the FDA on one of your the lectures that were on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably homeopathy we were talking about.
Yeah, the homeopathy. That's one. Right. And you got to, what you said, I wasn't sure if you were just glossing over the details, because I know it's a lot of depth to cover in a short amount of time, or if there was actually a misconception there. You said all it takes to get FDA approval is to prove that
it doesn't hurt you.
That it doesn't hurt you.
Right.
That, of course,
that's what I meant that as is as, and it's my understanding, and keep in mind, I'm the idiot here, but it's my understanding that to get approval as a nutritional supplement, you have to prove that it's not going to hurt you. You don't have to support claims of efficacy at all. I mean, you have to do that little disclaimer thing of, I'm not actually claiming this will cure whatever, but it's called the such and such cure.
So actually, for supplements, you don't even have to prove safety.
Really?
So under Deshaies, for supplements, it's, you just can market it without any burden of proof for safety or efficacy, as long as you have the disclaimer and are careful about how you state the claims. It's the burden of proof is on the FDA to prove that the product is harmful in order to take it off the market.
Nice.
Wow.
What you said, however, applies to homeopathy, which is what you were talking about. But you made it. But you weren't clear about what category of rules you were talking about.
Yeah, no, chalk it up to me being an idiot. I mean, I'm very aware of the strict double-blind, five 10-year studies that they do.
Yeah.
And it was sort of it's at the end of 80 minutes of talking to these kids, and they're starting to get restless, and so certainly factual errors are going to slip in there.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, because for actual drugs, you need to prove of safety and efficacy, and you have to restrict your claims to the efficacy that's proven.
It's don't you find it socially awkward sometimes to be a skeptic and to know certain things? It was very difficult for me early in my enlightenment. The way I fell into skepticism is back in college. I took a course from Dr. Rory Coker at the University of Texas at Austin, and it was an alternative to the standard introductory physics course called pseudoscience. And it was a semester-long course. Essentially, what became my lecture, with his blessing and permission, was the lecture's my effort to take what I learned over the course of that semester. For example, it's like, okay, today is astrology, and we're going to start with astrology, and today is the tarot cards, and let's move on to the next subject. And by the end of it, just knowing the background of everything blew my brains out. And as a result, it took 5 years after that course for me to learn how to properly engage other people. And not be a total jerk when somebody mentions, oh, I'm going to take Zicam. Oh, you're a big idiot. That doesn't do nothing.
Right. So did you start your career as a magician? Did that come before the skepticism?
They were concurrent. Hmm. I think and it happens with a lot of magicians. Once you get familiar with the tools used to deceive people and you start to see how malleable memory is and how easy it is to take advantage of other people, you see things a little bit different. At the time in college, I thought I was pulling a fast one, because I went to this honors program at University of Texas called Plan 2, and the last thing you had to do to graduate, you see, I had to spend a full semester working on a thesis, and somehow I talked my way into doing a magic show as a creative writing thesis. And at the time, I thought I was pulling a fast one on the university. Little did I know that it would become a career, and I'd be one of the few individuals actually working in his field by the time he graduated. Mm-hmm. And of course, during that time, I enjoyed that pseudoscience course so much that I encouraged all my roommates to take it the following year, and I ghosted it a second time. And then, in fact, the third year was my senior thesis year, and I got that professor, Dr. Rory Coker, to be my advisor. And under the excuse of, well, he's the only guy who knows about magic, and you have to have a magician in order to judge magic. It's been just an amazing experience. So I would say the two grew concurrently, and it was tough to decide where I wanted to end up, and I seemed to be trying to straddle both.
And that's essentially your stage performance is a combination of magic and skepticism then.
There, I try to keep them separate from a branding perspective. If somebody is wanting to go see a wild and crazy party, they don't also want to spend 10 minutes learning about the history of homeopathy. Traditionally, you never know. I mean, I get some weird gigs. I've given the lecture in a pub once while people were drinking and dancing all around me. But so I actually have two shows. I have my live stage show, which is Brian Brushwood Bizarre Magic, which has the stuff like the fire eating, the escapes, sticking nails in my eyes, breaking 30-pound bricks over my head, some sideshow stunts, some mind reading. And I guess 2004 was when I wrote Scam Sasquatch and the Supernatural, which is a 70-minute lecture that covers everything from starting with divinations, homeopathy, ESP, talk about malleable memory and UFOs and ESP and I'm telling you there's too much when you watch the whole thing. It's like, clearly I can't give enough time to anything.
So you either do your magic show or your skeptical lecture, but you don't cross the streams.
Yes, although I do get booked for double features quite a bit. A lot of universities will have me in and offer them a discounted price on the lecture because I'm already there, and what's it to me to stick around for another hour and give a talk? And I'm always shocked at how many people stick around for the lecture and especially stick around to the end, because by the time we finish a double feature, I've gone 2.5, almost 3 hours, and people are still there. And what's amazing is the show will end and people will come up and they'll still have more questions. And every time it's the same thing. It's like I'll lay down the foundations of pseudoscience about how, look, you can't trust anything anyone remembers about anything ever. So if you have a story that involves somebody remembering something already, let's throw that out. And second of all, it's got to stand up to the rigors of double blind tests and et cetera, et cetera. Lay all this out. And I have a big section on probability, because a lot of people, because every time the show ends and somebody comes up and they say, well, yeah, how about this? And they go on to tell some crazy story that involves a coincidence that's too amazing to just be natural chance. And that's one thing I try to prove is that these coincidences aren't just likely. They're bound to happen sooner or later.
It would be amazing if they didn't happen every
day. Exactly. And that's literally what I say is, you know, we live in an amazing, expansive universe. It would be more amazing if they didn't happen.
That would require an explanation. It would defy the odds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like the woman that won the lotto twice within a few months or a year or so, and people are saying that. But that's 1 in 30 trillion or whatever. And it might be 1 in 30 trillion for that specific person to win it. But the fact that somebody won it twice, the odds were like 1 in 25 or something crazy, because so many people play, there's bound to be a coincidence like that of having somebody winning twice in a very short period of time. It's bound to happen with the law of large numbers.
Well, I guess the Fermi problem take on that was, would you say, okay, the odds are 1 in 30 trillion? Well, I mean, have 30 trillion people played the lottery twice? Well, then it's probably pretty likely that in that sample size, you're going to have one that actually hits twice.
So, Brian, you say that you're pretty much at the beginning of your career, it sounds like. I mean, you're obviously a young guy just from your picture and your videos. It doesn't seem like you've gotten integrated into the mainstream skeptical movement. In other words, like, I don't see you at all the events, you know. But you seem to be a complete natural given the combination of magic and skepticism. I mean, that's as core as it gets to the skeptical movement. So is there a reason for that, or you just haven't had time to really make connections yet or network?
I suspect it's a combination of circumstance and opportunity. The circumstance, you know, one thing, the circumstance of the fact that for years, I guess I spent 8 to 10 years full-time touring, and all my performances were live events. And live events, you know, at the low end, you might have a small event with 50 to 100 people, or you might have a big event, you know, 600 to 800 people. But the problem is, on the great scale of things, as far as you have no permanent record of it, and even the memories get fuzzy after 2 days. If you have a really clever witticism on stage, people will laugh for that evening. You'll get 700 people laughing for that evening. If you have a clever witticism on the internet or on any kind of mass distribution medium, it lives forever and ever and ever. And it's really only been in the last couple of years since, I guess, before Scam School, there was Brian Brushwood on the Road. That's when really I started putting everything out there on the internet. So I guess after 7 years of live touring, I'm finally trying to introduce myself. And I guess it's been like 3 years since I posted that Scams lecture. So I guess right about now is when you would kind of expect it to start to get discovered and the snowball rolling.
Well, you know, there's also things like the Amazing Meeting that's coming up in July and other skeptical events like that. Have you been to any of those?
When I went to TAM 3, because I think that was 2004 when I was writing the 2004 when I was writing Scam, Sasquatch, and the Supernatural. It was, and of course, and again, talk about circumstance and timing. I look out and I'm very excited. I'm like, oh, I'm going to have this high energy kind of presentation, bringing science and debunking the paranormal. And literally, I was putting the finishing touches on the lecture, and Penn and Teller's Brilliant Show came out on Showtime. And I'm like, And I think that was also a circumstance of it. But I went to the Amazing Meeting, had a wonderful time. With the touring schedule, it's always a coin toss whether or not I'm able to make certain events. But certainly, I'm finally meeting and knowing the right people. I've known Teller from Penn and Teller for years. He's been a fantastic mentor on the artistic side of developing magic. But only now, only this year did I get the chance to meet James Randi, and I'm becoming friends with Andrew Main and a lot of the JREF crowd. And I think it just swimming in different pools for a long time. And now, only now am I finally coming to where I seem to intellectually belong.
Tell us about the mentalism act that you do, because that's, I mean, again, it seems to me that it would be, I can't imagine if somebody could be a successful mentalist and not be a skeptic. I mean, those two things seem to go hand in hand.
I agree. And it's really weird to see the people who, even the ones who include a disclaimer during their performance saying everything's, you know, not, but they clearly are trading on the perception that they are psychic. There's a couple of entertainers who work the college markets, who are a couple of them pretty well known, who, very unusual, actually called me up to challenge me when they heard I was going to be making a skeptical lecture. And in fact, one of them, you know, trying to please everyone. And these are entertainers. You know, they all know that they don't have psychic powers. But the original title for the lecture was Scam Psychics and Sasquatch, I think. And they were like, well, I don't like this. I work as a psychic entertainer, and you're going around, you're trashing my profession. And if it was, you know, if it was somebody like a John Edward, I'd be like, well, up yours, who cares? But because it's a fellow entertainer, it's and somebody who's doing some of the same routines that I do, I felt the need to kind of play nice. But it was very unusual to see how uncomfortable somebody who, I don't know, works in the arts as an entertainer and who you would think would be cool with that kind of thing, they suddenly weren't.
Do they feel – they must feel threatened by it,
though. You know, I think they were – you know, I think what it is whether – they just don't want to have that conversation again with the people where they don't want to finish a show and then have a student come up and say, we had a guy on last week who says you're a big faker. And, you know, and maybe because the character or their performance doesn't allow them to say, oh, yes, no, I'm a very big faker. You know, somebody like Banachek, very awesome. He's going to be totally fine. He has the most brilliant line. He says, oh, yeah, I'm a totally faker. What I do is I take my five natural senses and I combine them and use trickery in order to create the illusion of a sixth sense. That's what's going on here. There are people who are comfortable saying, yeah, this is all BS. And then there are other people who kind of like I don't know. I think they kind of like the little bit of the hero worship that happens with it.
Are there two camps within the magic culture?
From what I understand, I'm not a member of the PEA, the Psychic Entertainers Association. But from what I understand, there's sort of a weird rift where there are people who really believe that they have the psychic mojo, and then there are people who do actually good performances and rely on trickery. So I would love to see the conversations that go down in that regard.
That's it. That's interesting because that wasn't the split I was thinking of. I was thinking more that they're all fake and know that they're fake, but there are those who want to keep the mystique as part of the entertainment and the act, and those who feel obliged to at least be upfront about the fact that it's not real. But you're saying there are some that are believers?
Oh, yeah, yeah, and actual members of wow. – and the reason is because somebody who – whenever you go to a psychic fair and they're doing the palm reading and the crystal ball gazing and all that stuff, those are people who actually think they've got the gift a lot of the time. A lot of the time. And, of course, they're using cold reading and body posture, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, they want benefits and they want insurance and blah, blah, blah. So they join the Psychic Entertainers Association. They're like, I'm psychic. I'm an entertainer. And then there are other people, you know, brilliant people like Banachek, who knows he's using trickery to create the illusion of psychics. And so they join as well. And I'd love to see, you know, the annual dinner that I imagine they have.
Yeah, right.
So there's only three camps. That's interesting.
I think there's definitely a place for psychic entertainment. And I'm using psychic, you know, like I call it cartoon ESP, like, you know, like the way you would think of Professor X or the X-Men or, you know, some kind of mutant power. I don't mind using the word psychic and ESP as a shorthand to mean that. As long as you make it clear to me, whatever you say on stage, as long as when the show's over, you just look them right in the eye and say, no, dude, it was a trick. Calm down.
Right. But that's the rift that I know about, that's where you have essentially James Randi and, you know, Penn and Teller and Banachek on one side saying that we owe it to the public and it's unethical almost to pretend like there is some actual mystical effect going on, versus other ones who say, no, it's part of the act and you're ruining it. It's like it's the same. They equate it with, you know, publicly exposing the way magic tricks are done,
right?
Like a la the Masked Magician.
Although it's been really interesting since the internet has come to town, that the internet has changed all the rules, and it's even changed the standards of what will make magicians complain. When we launched Scam School, a show that's about teaching magic tricks to everyday people to impress your friends at the bar, I was terrified, absolutely terrified, that the wrath of the magic community and the mentalism community would come down upon me the way it did for the Masked Magician. But what I discovered was that the scene is so different now, where every 16-year-old with a webcam can tell you the secret to every single thing and record it in a YouTube video, and the production quality is poor and the effect is poorly represented and it shows no respect to the source material. All of a sudden, a show where the guy's really talking up the effect and trying to get people excited about performing, all of a sudden, that's a breath of fresh air to these guys.
What a difference. Wow.
Yeah, that's interesting, because with the advent of TV and movies – that the magic profession radically changed. Prior to that, there was only live shows. As you say, so you could develop your live show and then perform it 1,000 times around the world. But once your show was shown on television, everyone has seen
it.
You
and they want to know what's new. Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
It's dead.
Completely changed things, that magicians had to constantly be coming up with new material. And now I think the internet is, from what you're saying, carrying out yet another change where the basic tricks are on YouTube, you know, so you
right.
can't rely upon your audience not knowing some of the basic fundamentals of how to do these tricks. So what does that mean for the average magician like you, that you have to take the tricks a level deeper or two levels deeper, or is it more performance than
the tricks? You would think so, but surprisingly, here's my theory on where we're headed with information, and essentially information distribution technologies and magic. It used to be that the gap between the performer and the attendee at a magic show was very, very big. In the 1700s, there was the performer, and then there was the crowd. And if you wanted to know how the performer did it, you had one choice, and that was to apprentice under him, and slowly he would reveal his secrets to you. How quickly did that change when the discovery of witchcraft came out, the first book of magic tricks that revealed how conjurers were able to pull their tricks? And now all of a sudden, you enter the age where it's libraries. And now the answer to, and to this day, the answer to any magic trick you've ever seen in your entire life is written up in your local library, probably in your elementary school library. But magicians have the saying, they say, if you want to hide it, put it in a book. So there's still a barrier to entry. You have to know what to search for. You have to be able to care enough that you sit there and riffle through all the pages. And now we're at the age of the internet where literally you can watch a magic trick on television and Google the answer instantly. And now the barrier is so tiny that we've essentially entered the age where magic is in the gaps. And now the only gap left is a willful contract between the person who wants to be fooled and the magician who says, I'm now going to fool you. And if you want to talk about the smallest version of all this, for a while, Penn & Teller's opening bit was an escape. And the escape was, they used to say, look, we're going to do this escape. You're going to see exactly how it's done. So what kind of person are you? Are you the kind of person who wants to experience magic, or are you the kind of person who wants to see a middle-aged person get out of a box? And half the audience would close their eyes, and they would experience magic. And they would tell people how – I mean, nowadays, even with, you know, how many times we're talking about, oh, did you see Lost last night? No, don't tell me. I've got it on TiVo. It's become socially acceptable to say, no, I'm wrapping my own present here. And that's, you know, so magic falls into the same category now. And also magicians tend to be paranoid about this kind of thing, but we forget how bad memory is. I get fooled by tricks I learned 10 years ago because I've already forgotten how they're done. And when you talk like the Masked Magician, I defy anybody to name three tricks that the Masked Magician revealed and how he did them. Nobody can remember because we all have such terrible videotapes in our head. So I think magic will be just fine. This is everyone's crying, but it's going to be okay.
And I like what you've done with the internet, Brian. I mean, you've taken what you do, and you have basically embraced Web 2.0. You've embraced the internet, and you've exposed yourself as much as you can through Scam School, YouTube, iTunes. You've basically taken every avenue possible in helping build your exposure through the internet. You haven't, you know, shied away from it. You've embraced it. And I think that's very cool.
I'm really happy to hear you say that. And it's funny because, again, 20 years ago, the only way for you to achieve any kind of level of fame was you did your time working stage shows, and then you got discovered by some magical lottery, and then all of a sudden you're the one guy who won the tournament, and you get to be the magician for this decade on network television. And I had a brief, I guess about four or five years ago, I got hired to put together a project for Court TV, and I wanted to focus very heavily on teaching the inside tools. I wanted to focus on pseudoscience and the paranormal, debunking that kind of thing. And we put together – my project got handed off midway through, and I inherited, you know, from somebody who got me and the person who brought me in to begin with to somebody from VH1 who did not get me and who just said, I just want the zazz. I want the wow. And they used all that TV talk that drives me freaking nuts. And they got they chose to do the cheapest of the thing. And then the last minute they said, look, we also need you to comb your hair and wear this sweater. And what they – and, you know, again, this is my first dance with television, so I'm like, sure, I'll do whatever you say. They got a very bland, very bad product, and of course they passed on it. And it was around this time that really interesting things were happening with podcasting and online development. YouTube was exploding.
And I realized, I was like, I could care less about television. What I want is to reach more people and to have this medium where you can be a middle-class rock star. You can reach enough people to sustain your business and to engender real fans. So immediately I was like, okay, what's it going to take to get an internet TV show? And the first thing I realized was, well, I need to have already hosted an internet TV show. And so since I hadn't done anything, I was like, well, what do I got? Well, I'm on tour. I got a couple like hand cameras. Okay, I'm going to make up a show. It's called Brian Brushwood on the Road. 5-minute episodes of just goofy stuff happening while I'm on the road. And sure enough, a year later, when we got to pitching Scam School, it was the fact that I spent a year just goofing off, putting the stuff out there. The fact that I was able to point them to a YouTube clip from a lecture that, you know, that had however many thousand views at the time, that that I think really helped make it to get the project started, to get Scam School started.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the internet, it's a great, you know, low cost, convenient way to first just get your material out there to a broad audience, and also a very selective audience, because generally it's probably going to be people who are searching for your kind of content. And then it also becomes your audition for more things, for more stuff, right? So it creates its own opportunities.
You are absolutely correct. It's sort of like the minor leagues for radio or the minor leagues for television, which previously had always been maybe local markets. But now you're able to cast such a wide net. And the what's great is the cream really rises to the top. If the public latches onto something, something can become an overnight hit. This show can go from nothing to a million views per episode almost overnight nowadays. It's really a wonderful, exciting time. It's the Wild West, the 1950s of television all over again.
Yeah, I agree. Although, as you alluded, you know, TV and radio, the old traditional media is still the big time. But I'm not sure how long you think it's going to take before the internet is the big time, and you know the other things are an afterthought, or essentially they've merged. You know, that they're all the same thing. Actually,
I would like to think that, but I was really bummed out when we did This Week in Media. I was fortunate enough to guest on that, and one of the topics was the Nielsen numbers still showed that 99% of all video is still watched on traditional televisions, and even stuff that I thought was obvious, like by now doesn't everybody watch everything time shifted on TiVo? And the number was like, I think it was like 7% of all video was watched, like the vast majority, 2/3 to 90%. I'm making these numbers up, but the vast majority is still old school. Turn on the television and see what's on.
Getting back to magic for a second, there was the other point I wanted to make. We were talking about how the internet is changing the magic profession. And you know, I agree that short-term memory is probably the magician's best friend. But also, tell me if you agree with this, and I think the last time I saw Banachek performed is when this really came home to me, is that what magicians are having to do now is they have to be able to do the same trick 10 different ways. And they reveal one way and make the audience think this is the way this trick is done, but really there's 10 ways that trick is done. So they make that's how they put the audience off their game, by letting them think they know how it's done, but really it's more complicated.
You are absolutely correct. And in fact, this is the hilarious backstory that nobody knows about the Masked Magicians. The methods he revealed, there were a couple of them where he did straight up reveal how magicians actually do it nowadays. But by and large, all the methods that the Masked Magician revealed were so antiquated and so hilariously outdated that somebody who watched that show and then watched a modern performer would actually be more impressed, because he thought he knew how all this is done. Oh, this is the part where he's, oh, oh, wait, no, that's not how he did it on TV. And all of a sudden they have no idea how it's done. But the perception, because the marketing was, we're ruining it for you, that's why that guy got crucified. But it's interesting, because what people really wanted was the illusion of an answer. And if a magician can set up the illusion of an answer and then yank that away from somebody, absolutely, that's the core of what we do to deceive. It's that cognitive dissonance of you know, wait a minute, no, it was in my hand, but this is in my hand now. How did that happen?
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us on the Skeptic's Guide. It's been a pleasure having you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. You guys are a huge fan. Tremendously excited to be. Like I said, I wasn't joking when I say it's a privilege and an honor. It's a big deal for me.
Well, thanks, and definitely shoot us an email if you're going to be at TAM.
Yes, definitely. I'll let everybody know.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Cool.
Thanks, Brian.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Everyone ready for this week?
Mm-hmm. My gloves are on. I am ready.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. A review of the published literature shows that almost 25% of all animal species engage in same-sex behavior. Item number two, a new study finds that those with autism are 40% faster on tests of problem solving than matched controls. Item number three, scientists estimate that high-altitude winds could provide enough energy to meet world demands 100 times over. Bob, go first.
You're going to wait, my friend. Let's see. 25% of all animal species engage in same-sex behavior. That seems a little high. Let's see. Those with autism, 40% faster on tests of problem-solving than matched controls. 40% faster. That doesn't sound right. Are you trying to get everyone to think that autistics are rain men? All right, high altitude winds, world demand 100 times over. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that tapping in using all available high altitude winds? That possibly, if you look at it that way, if you tap it maximally, then maybe it would be a lot.
Big one.
Rebecca, do you have any fours?
Go fish.
Oh, darn it.
All right. One more. Let me just look at them again. Hang on.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, 25%. All right, I'm going to buy... all the homosexual animals. I'm going to go with that one.
Bob has purchased all the homosexual animals.
I don't know. Maybe with maybe they would do it faster because they're just so focused and they're not... I mean, because one of the hallmarks of autism is that they're just so inward. They just kind of ignore... or try to ignore everything that's going on around them, that maybe they can just focus really, really well. I could kind of have that make sense. Then the high-altitude winds, world demand. Oh, man. All right, I'm going to go with the world demand 100 times over. That seems like too much.
Okay, Rebecca?
I'll say that's fiction.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is Bob finished?
Yeah.
Okay. 25% of all animal species engage in same-sex behavior. Unlike Bob, I think that actually sounds a little lower than I thought. Because, look, you're talking about what kind of animals make up most of the world's population? Insects, right? So, I mean, unless you include bacteria or something. But earthworms. Earthworms are the biggest flaming homos you'll ever meet. They're awesome.
Aren't they hermaphrodites?
Well, they are. And so they often, get it on with each other with their, same-sex parts.
Well, what choice do they have? I see. Okay.
It doesn't matter if they have a choice. None of them have a choice, Bob. Okay?
Depends what state
it's not a choice. So the question is about same-sex behavior. And that occurs all over the place. Bonobos are figuring
out. With the bonobos. You love the bonobos, huh?
I love sexy
I point to humans,
bonobos.
But that's
so, yeah, 25% of all animal species do engage in same-sex behavior. And the ones that say they don't are lying.
No.
People with autism are 40% faster on tests of problem solving. I can definitely see that because autism doesn't necessarily affect your problem solving skills. Autism usually affects your social interactions. So there's no reason why you wouldn't be able to solve problems just as fast as anyone else. It's just that you don't like to hug quite as much. So that leaves high-altitude winds providing energy to meet the world's demands 100 times over. I'm sorry, Steve, that's silly. I think that the winds are actually dying down these days, and I can't believe you thought I'd fall for that.
Okay, Evan?
Well, regarding the 25% of all animal species engaging in same-sex behavior, I agree with Rebecca. I think that number to me struck me as a little bit low, but they apparently have plotted it, and I think that is science. The next one, with 40% those with autism are 40% faster on tests of problem solving than match controls. I think that is correct. I think the trick here is that, yeah, they're faster on the tests. It doesn't mean they're getting the answers right, but they're just blowing through the tests faster. So I think that's correct.
Yeah.
And therefore, the high altitude winds meeting the world demand for energy 100 times over. That's a lot of wind. How would you even harness that wind anyways? But still, I think that's just over the top, as they say. And that one
Kites.
Is fiction.
Okay. Well, let's start with the second one. A new study finds that those with autism are 40% faster on tests of problem solving than match controls. That one is science.
Sweet.
That one is science.
Yay.
Very interesting. And when I said match controls, they actually matched them for IQ. So this was not a difference in intelligence. And they did find that on some standardized tests of problem solving that autistic subjects were able to perform 40% faster. They were no more accurate. They did not perform better. They were just were able to perform faster. And Bob, the hypothesis that you raised about being more focused and less distracted or whatever, that is a classic sort of idea about why some autistic people do seem to have these increased savant type abilities. But that's essentially been debunked. That's not any longer the prevailing thought. It appears that it's not just focus or attentiveness or lack of being distracted by other things.
What is it then?
Well, if you remember, and again, there's still a lot that we don't understand, but we talked about this also about the chimpanzees being able to do certain things quicker. Maybe there's the processing is more straightforward. Some of the frontal lobe processing might not be there, and therefore might enable certain decision making or problem solving to occur quicker.
Okay,
that's still speculative. So that's one possibility. And Rebecca is right in that autism essentially is a decrease in social focus and ability. Some people have described it as an extreme male brain. For example,
whoa, really?
Which is interesting, and it also may be trading off the kind of abilities that would tend towards, say, math and engineering for trading social ability for increased ability in these other areas.
And don't boys tend to get it more often?
Yes, it does occur more often in males than in females, which is one of the clues as to what might be going on with autism. And which has led some researchers to think that maybe it has something to do with testosterone, boys may already be part of the way there, as it were, and therefore it's easier to shift them into the spectrum than girls. There's still a lot of hypotheses, but no definitive answers yet as far as those kinds of questions are. So very interesting that they were able to show that even when you match for IQ, that the problem solving was quicker, not better, but quicker among the autistic subjects. You guys all believe that scientists estimate that high altitude winds could provide enough energy to meet world demands 100 times over. You all thought that one was fiction,
mm-hmm.
and that one is science.
Oh.
Whoa!
Yeah, I'm not too surprised, I guess.
Nice job, Steve.
Think of the power in the jet stream.
You set us up and you knocked us down. Nice.
100 times over is a lot of energy up there, and the optimal...
No, I swear to God, I read that the winds are actually dying down.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Not at 30,000 feet, apparently.
Maybe
the jet stream would be the place to do it. And the study actually was not just looking at the amount of energy that's up there, but also the feasibility of using high-flying kites. Basically, you have a tether tied to a very, very high-flying windmill-type device that generates electricity and sends the current that it generates down the tether to where it's used or stored or whatever. And this could be used to generate quite a lot of electricity. one of the advantages of being up so high is that it would be out of the way of a lot of stuff, right?
Weather.
Like, wouldn't be in the way of, it wouldn't be in the way of bird or bat migrations or anything like that.
Right.
I guess the tethers would be a menace to navigation. You couldn't literally be harvesting all of the jet stream. You'd have to have it in, I guess, concentrated areas. What they found is that the best areas to concentrate these would be actually in the same locations where we have major cities, which actually could be convenient. So New York City, for example, could be a prime location to have a bunch of these high-flying kites tethered and generating electricity for use, you know, right where it's needed. The primary drawback of this type of energy production is that even though when you get to higher altitudes, like, for example, in the jet stream, the winds are blowing quite steadily, they're still blowing only 95% of the time. It's still most of the time, but that means 5% of the time the winds might die down. And if that happens, you know, you can't have the city go dark 5% of the time. You know, you
right.
You would need to have an infrastructure in place to buffer, you know, this electricity, to either store it and then release it during the lulls, or to have secondary, you know, sources of electricity that can take up the slack when necessary. So that would be a major infrastructure, you know, engineering problem is producing a steady flow of current even for these the you know 5% or so, the brief lulls in the winds.
Yeah, it can't store it.
Did they specifically say that they want to tap into the jet stream?
Yeah.
Because, well, that's odd, because we've all seen the weather guy on TV showing the jet stream and how it moves. I mean, it affects weather. It completely, the different times of the year, it's all over the place. So you can't necessarily be always tapped into the jet stream then.
They do characterize them as meandering belts of fast winds.
Right.
At altitudes between 20 and 50,000 feet that shift seasonally. So I guess you'd have to shift, you know, these things, the windmills, the high-flying kites with them, I guess.
Or have enough so that at even the low ebb of the season, of the year, you're still getting enough energy, not peak.
But they were saying that the high densities would be, say, along the eastern coast of the United States. So the location where we have most of our cities happens to be a location where they would be persistent most of the time.
See, they strike me as being very, very vulnerable, though.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about this 25% of animal species?
Yeah. A review of the published literature shows that almost 25% of all animal species engage in same-sex behavior, and that one is fiction.
But come on, they're all doing it.
Is the number higher or lower?
What do you think? So Evan and Rebecca thought that number was low. Bob thought the number was high. Bob, you still think the number is high?
Yeah, what the hell? I'll stick with my initial.
Okay, so Evan and Rebecca, you guys are right. What do you think the real number is?
40%.
I would say 60.
Actually, they found that it is nearly universal, almost 100%.
What?
What?
That's awesome. That actually fits in with what I originally said, is that
the ones that
you said they
did
in our line.
Nearly universal. The authors say it's clear that same-sex sexual behavior extends far beyond the well-known examples that dominate both the scientific and popular literature. For example, bonobos, they're always first at the list. Dolphins, penguins, and fruit flies. That was a quote from
Dolphins.
Bailey.
Forgot about them. They're always getting on, man.
Right. This raises the question, if it's so common in the animal kingdom, it suggests that there's some evolutionary advantage to having a certain percentage of a species population engage a certain percentage of the time in same-sex sexual behavior. And there are some ideas about what selective forces might be at work there, and it's probably different for different species. We shouldn't assume that it's the same thing in all species. They give some specific example. For example, the Laysan albatross. But they said that, for example, when males are scarce, that female-female bonding becomes more common, and that two females will even pair bond for life and raise each other's chicks. I guess they still have to have an encounter with a male at some point.
Well, presumably.
Well, yeah.
So it's partly a reaction to stress, partly a plan B, you know, for those who can't find mates. It also, in other species at other times, it may increase bonding. I think among primates, that's an important bonding element.
Bonobos.
Right. For bonobos, right. So in reviewing the literature, they found that pretty much all species, it's been observed to some degree and may serve some social purpose.
Hmm.
So I swept you guys this week.
Yeah.
I blame Jay. I still think you're wrong.
Yeah, if Jay were here.
If Jay were here, this would have been totally different.
I know. Then he would have swept four of us.
Evan.
Yes, sir.
Who's that noisy?
Let's replay last week's Who's That Noisy.
So, Evan, what was that noisy?
That was the Cassini-Huygens passing through Saturn's rings.
Cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
And was that its radio signal or something from it?
It was particles bombarding the actual
But still, how was that
probe
noise being transmitted to the Earth?
No, I think they anticipated that. Weren't they not even sure it was going to survive?
So I think an audio recorder on the probe? That'd be interesting.
My guess would be that they totally anticipated that and had a specific recorder just for that.
They had it recording as it entered the ring, and then there's space between the rings. So obviously the noise dies down. Then it hits the next ring, and they recorded it again, or at least they transmitted it to Earth. It went through a transmission process, and they recorded it down here at Earth.
So, Evan, play us this week's Who's That Noisy.
All right. Now, folks, you might have to play this back a couple times. Well, when you hear it, you'll understand to try to, gauge exactly who's that noisy.
Many memorandums were drawn up as to a general system that would permit of the subdivision of the light into small units analogous to gaseous and with commercial economy superior to the prevailing gas system.
Yeah, that was rough.
Yeah, that was a little rough.
You might have to go back and listen to that a couple times to try to figure out who was that speaking. So good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
So Jay's not here, so I have a quote for this week. I'm going to tell you the quote because I'm going to do it my way, and then you can think about who might have said this. Who said this? Agnosticism simply means that a man shall not say he knows or believes that for which he has no grounds for professing to believe.
Hume.
No.
Huxley.
Yep.
Oh,
Thomas Henry Huxley. T.H. Huxley.
He invented agnosticism.
Yeah, it's kind of obvious.
I knew it was an H last name.
T.H. Huxley.
I call him Thuxley.
Thuxley.
Someone had to do it.
Darwin's Bulldog. Always good for a quote.
Good man.
Absolutely.
Maybe
wouldn't
we'll
that be cool to be quoted by people like 100 years after?
Yeah, that would be
Not
cool.
Not really. I wouldn't really know.
Still.
Sorry, did I bring it down with my agnosticism?
A few quick announcements. The amazing meeting, July 9th to 12th. It's getting close, but if there's any possibility of being there, it's going to be a great time. Science-based medicine conference, July 9th. And we are still open for dinner with the SGU Friday night on July 10th.
We're nearly all full, though, so people get your registration.
Yes. Send us an email. We'll confirm with you if we still have room, and then we'll give you instructions on how to pay. Well, thank you all for joining me once again.
Thank you, Steve.
This was good. Thanks, Steve.
Yep, a lot of fun. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org.
For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.